backseat, polish and cram, we're going down, going down.
Well, Bush 2 is in the White House, just passing tax reforms, giving trillions to his rich friends, and stealing from the poor. Don't blink your eyes, he'll sell the store.
Corporations and the Pentagon just cooking up the wars. Condos in the State House, ancient world, in the Ocon, in the Ocon.
Well, Poppy Bush and Baby Bush and the Party of God, that spelled G for guns and O for oil and D for drugs. They gave us 911. Was an inside job.
George Bush in the White House, spreading fear across the land, tearing up our Bill of Rights as fast as they can. War on terror, such a scam.
Well, Collins at the UN just showing diagrams. Can't you see those weapons just scattered across the land? He's making deals, he's shaking hands.
Got blood on his hands. Wolfie's at the World Bank making new demands. We'll take your oil, you keep the sand.
We got Abu Ghraib in the Middle East, Guantanamo down south. Congress got that Patriot Act just shoved on down its mouth. It took our Constitution and threw it out.
We'll call over in the White House and they say he's Bush's brain. All his corporate buddies and their voting machines. We cast our votes, they wipe them clean.
Neo-Nazis stole the White House, now they're shooting for the world. Torture and police states and preemptive war. The Fourth Reich's here in America.
King George in the White House is pushing folks around. Cheney's in the backseat, polishing the crown. We're going down, we're going down.
You're listening to KHEN LPFM Radio 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community supported radio. We are streamed on the internet at khen.org, and if you'd like to listen to tonight's program or any past programs of Truth Quest, they are now available at www.givemesometruth.info or linked from khen.org website. I am Melody, and my co-host tonight is Dr. Eric Carlstrom and Katie O'Brien. And our special guest tonight is Jerry E. Smith. And this opening song was White House Blues, performed and written by Dr. Eric Carlstrom. And again, KHEN is... Oops. And I'm hoping we got everybody here. Do we have Jerry, Katie? Can you hear me?
Katie? Yeah.
There you guys go. Takes a minute here to get everything figured out, but I think I've got everybody. And I wanted to get some... Okay, support for KHEN and Truth Quest, brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Properties, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at coloradohomeproperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And Jerry E. Smith was born in 1950 in Panoma, California, is the author, poet, editor, and activist. His bibliography of published works includes scores of nonfiction articles, reviews, and more than a dozen ghostwritten books and 3 nonfiction books from Adventures Unlimited Press. He's a close friend and literary partner of the late Jim Keith. They worked together on magazines, books, and co-hosted a radio show broadcast from the campus of the Oregon Institute of Technology. Jerry Smith's first book from Adventures Unlimited Press was HARP, H-A-A-R-P, The Ultimate Weapon of Conspiracy, which considered conspiracy theories connected to high-frequency active auroral research project. The book, published in 1998, was
has been described as blurring the lines between fiction and nonfiction by detractors and as comprehensive and erudite by other reviewers. His other book that he has done is Weather Warfare, written in 2006, and covers the history of weather modification from the rainmakers of the 1890s through the development of cloud seeding in the middle of the 20th century to today's suspected ability to manipulate hurricanes. Katie,
yes.
Are you there? And Dr. Carlstrom?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. And Jerry?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, Jerry, do you have anything to add to your biography there to kind of...
Well, that's from Wikipedia, and I made the mistake of putting that up on Wikipedia myself, and apparently that's a no-no, and the Wikipedia Nazis got very huffy about it and threatened to take it down, and then edited it rather interestingly, that they decided it wasn't objective enough, so they had to find a detractor, so that quote where it says that I blurred the lines between fiction and nonfiction, that's from a website in which the guy goes on for a couple of paragraphs about how wrong I am. Then at the end of it, he admits, but I haven't actually read his book.
That's objective journalism, yes.
Well, before we get too far, let me say the views expressed on this program are those of myself or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of KHIN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay, we'll let you go ahead from here. Dr. Carlstrom, do you have anything you'd like to...
Yes, Melody, I do. Thank you very much. Jerry, it's a pleasure to have you on the radio show. I've got a copy of your book, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, which you wrote in 1998, and a copy of your Weather Warfare book. I would like to jump right into the fray, if it's okay with you. I've got a website about 911. And the New World Order files is what it's called. I can give that website link a little bit later. But basically, what I'm coming around to after having studied this for many years is seriously considering the ideas of Dr. Judy Wood that would suggest that the Twin Towers, World Trade Center 1 and 2, came down by, at least in part, by directed energy weapons of some kind, she calls exotic weapons. And I know you wrote your book HARP in 1998, but I assume you've been keeping up with HARP, and I would like to ask your opinion as to whether HARP might account for the way those Twin Towers exploded and came down at the speed of gravity, basically with molecular dissociation of concrete and steel.
Well, that is an interesting take. I have not heard that before, to tell you the truth. My understanding of HARP is that it is not that focusable. It's not that directable. HARP is a field of antennas on the ground in southeastern Alaska, so linked together as to work as one giant antenna. And it is today the world's largest radio broadcasting station. But it's not designed to broadcast for human ears. It's designed to inject a fantastic amount of radio frequency energy into a spot at the very top of the atmosphere called the ionosphere. Now, the amount of energy that the field can currently output, and it was just completed the ribbon cutting ceremony to announce that they had finished building the HARP. The ribbon cutting ceremony was a year ago. I think it was like 13 months ago. But the evidence supports that they actually finished completing it right around Thanksgiving 2005, and it was announced as being completed by DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, in March of 2006, and yet the principal contractor, BAE Systems North America, dallied until the contract ran out before doing the ribbon-cutting ceremony. Now, the amount of energy that this thing can inject into the atmosphere is 3.6 million watts. The largest legal AM radio station in the United States is 50,000 watts. HARP is 72,000. 50,000-watt radio stations, injecting their entire effective radiated power into a spot about 12.5 miles across by about 2.5 miles deep by 50 or 90 miles up, depending on which mode they're operating in. Now, what that does is that heats that spot by several thousand degrees to the point where the molecules of the atmosphere literally blow apart. And when you break the molecules, that gives off a packet of energy, which includes a stream of ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves. And these ELF waves penetrate deep into the earth and deep into the sea. And the U.S. Navy admits to having used HARP to communicate with deeply submerged submarines for about 15 years now. HARP, at the time that the towers went down, HARP was in in a phase called the developmental prototype, with an effective radiated power of 960 kilowatts, substantially less than what it is now, but still, at the time, one of the world's greatest radio broadcasting stations. Now, the deal is that the ELF is such a long wave, it does circumnavigate the globe. So the whole world is directly affected by the ionospherically generated ELF. Though whether that can be focused at a building anywhere on the planet, much less specifically New York City, is I think rather extreme conjecture. Though it's hard to rule it out because we don't really know exactly what this thing can do.
Right. Of course, HARP includes and builds upon some of the exotic inventions of Nikola Tesla, the inventor who lived in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And one of his many, many inventions is, as you know, one of the greatest inventors, perhaps the greatest inventor of the last couple of hundred years anyway, was what he calls the death ray, or he called the death ray, where he described this, and of course I think he did patent these things, but much of that material was stolen upon his death, supposedly by the government. And this death ray, he called it a teleforce, that he could essentially melt airplane motors at a distance of 250 miles. And one of the reasons why I make this conjecture is that, I don't know if you've read the work of Dr. Judy Wood, but she talks about 130 toasted cars, and these had engine blocks that were just completely destroyed. Very mysterious effects were associated with the coming down of the Twin Towers, and have never really before been seen. These kinds of effects haven't been seen. So this is one of the reasons why I've made this conjecture.
But the Tesla death ray was one of the things I researched while writing the HARP book, and I concluded that HARP was not the death ray, and so only put minimal mention of it in the book, just so that the readers would know, yeah, I had researched it and moved on. But the death ray concept was an interesting idea that was played with over the following century by a number of governments. The idea, if I can remember this even sort of coherently, was that it was a two-phase thing. First of all, is he ionized a zone of the atmosphere to create a virtual wire to run the power down, and then a build-up and discharge of electrical energy down the ionized zone, similar to lightning. And he never actually got up to the point of working with hardware. It was all in his head. There were a number of notes, and I think there were a couple of patents, but I'm not sure. But I do know that the Soviets played with it. Actually, initially the French played with it between World War I and II. I think the French were playing with it in the 1920s. They abandoned it. They managed to only get it to go a few hundred yards. And then the Russians played with it, and they managed to get it to go about a quarter mile. They actually succeeded in frying a goat a quarter mile away from the transmitter, which showed promise, but the amount of energy and the lack of sophistication of the equipment of the 1930s convince both the French and the Soviets to abandon that line of research. And it's possible that that line of research has been picked up. I keep hearing rumors and stories about it, but there is if anybody has this technology, it is currently classified. Though there have been some wild stuff, like the Japanese doomsday cult was playing with some aspect of Tesla broadcast power and sending fireballs across the Australian outback in the 90s, and this may be related technology or may not, may be parallel development. It's hard to say.
Okay, well, let me just follow this up, Jerry. What you said about the death ray being causing an ionized zone in the atmosphere and then a discharge of energy down that ionized zone. Dr. Judy Wood she's got a PhD in engineering, materials engineering, and what she did in her study was to get all the photos she could of just before, just after, weeks after, months after the event of the Twin Towers. And she's had to develop a new vocabulary for the things that she sees, because there's nothing in our experience that really describes them. So the one thing that she describes is just before the towers, both towers came down, just before each of the towers came down, there's kind of a smoke. What she calls the towers get lathered up. There's a kind of a film of smoke that's seen on the outside of the towers that goes up quite a ways, and this immediately precedes the explosive destruction of the towers. And your description of the ionizing going on and then the discharge of energy down it like a lightning bolt sounds feasible. And then you certainly see molecular dissociation of the particles, so that the concrete and the steel are completely shattered, sent apart into nanoparticles.
Right. So we certainly do. It certainly does look like something other than conventional explosives was used. So it's not an area I have researched in any great depth. My take up until we had this conversation was that the buildings had been pre-wired for explosives, with explosives, because of the first attack on the towers in 93. The plan was to undermine the side of one so that it fell into the other, creating a domino effect and knocking down skyscrapers all across Manhattan in a wave of falling skyscraper dominoes. And there's a lot of people who think that at that point they wired the building so that if there were a second attack, they could prevent the domino effect from occurring. So that's kind of what I'd been thinking up until 20 minutes ago when you
well,
laid this
idea. There is good evidence. I think that there were pre-setting of explosions did occur, and certainly there were big explosions that rocked the buildings, particularly the lower floors. But the upper two-thirds seem to have been destroyed in a very unconventional manner, and different people suggest mini nukes and or directed energy weapons, which could include microwaves and all kinds of ELFs, I guess, or the death ray or something like that. And so this is, as you say, it's conjecture, but Judy Wood has done a lot of research, and she throws out a lot of these possibilities, and we have a pretty good inkling that many of these technologies do exist. So it's just
right.
A matter
well,
of
I do bring up in both the books, HARP, The Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, and Weather Warfare, The Military's Plan to Draft Mother Nature, that there are a lot of unconventional and reprehensible technologies that have been under development for the last century, and that one of the things that I bring up in HARP is the military. Let me collect my thoughts here for a moment. Non-conventional warfare You may remember after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there was all this talk about the peace dividend, which never really quite developed. And then there was the big talk was RMA, the Revolution in Military Affairs. And this was because we were moving from nukes, which are a somewhat unconventional conventional weapon, into very unconventional weapons, electromagnetic weapons. The big deal, and you do a, you can do a Google on this and find some amazing stuff. RMA, Revolution in Military Affairs, is the idea that we go through an RMA every time we change the fundamentals of how war is fought, such as when we went from cold steel to arrows, and we went from arrows to bullets, and from bullets to cannons. You know, we have gone from weapons that target individuals to weapons that target battlefields, to weapons that target cities, as with nukes, to weapons that, that target whole regions with electromagnetics. And that's where we stand now with weather weapons and electromagnetics, perhaps scalar weapons. We can target whole continents, maybe even whole planets. And that's an RMA, and that's one of the aspects that I discuss directly and indirectly in both those books.
Could you describe a little bit more about what you're talking about? I think you know, most of us have only a very vague idea of what you're mentioning when you talk about these electromagnetic weapons, these scalar weapons, and how they would be used, and how they would work.
As we discussed before we went on the air, I kind of need to borrow your eyes and mouth here for a moment. I want to
sure.
give a quote. My my book, Weather Warfare, begins with a quote from Secretary of Defense William S. Cohen. And the key to that quote is at the bottom of the first paragraph where it goes, others are developing. Do you have that handy? Can you?
Yeah.
Can you, yeah.
I'll do it. Katie, you want to do it?
Sure. So there are plenty of ingenious minds out there that are at work.
A little higher up where it says,
others are engaged even in an eco-type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves.
It's real, and that's the reason why we have to intensify our efforts. Now, Secretary Cohen said that in his official capacity as the Secretary of Defense at a conference on
terrorism,
weapons of mass
destruction in the U.S. strategy given on the 28th of April in 97.
Right, 97. I mean, this is the Secretary Cohen said that there are others, and of course, whenever the U.S. Government says that other eight governments have this capacity. They're saying that because they themselves have this capacity. And he says others, and he doesn't necessarily say other governments. This, of course, is a conference on terrorism, so he's implying that Libya and Al-Qaeda are in possession of this, and he maybe has been speaking directly about the Japanese doomsday cult. And he says, can, not will, maybe, sometime in the future, he says, can alter the climate, set off volcanoes, earthquakes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves. And that's one of the areas here. There have been developments in radio frequency technologies that are completely outside the ken of what Americans know about or what's being released on the 6 o'clock news. A little bits and pieces of this are coming out. You started with a quote from Wikipedia on my bio. Another page of Wikipedia that would be of interest is the active denial system. Your listeners might want to drop in on the Wikipedia page on the active denial system. It was first announced by the Marines as the VMAD, the vehicle-mounted active denial system. And basically, the VMAD is a microwave oven without a door mounted on top of a Hummer that you aim it at a crowd and the skin temperature of the people in the area being irradiated goes up about 180 degrees in less than 2 seconds. This is an electromagnetic crowd control device that I think is hilarious. The way we learned about this is in 2003, a reporter for one of the major periodicals like Popular Science got a hold of this thing and announced and dropped a note to the Marines saying, "Hey, you know, I know you guys have this thing, and we're going to run an article on it. You have anything to say?" And the general in charge of the Marines flipped out and said, "I'm not going to let them scoop me," and ordered that the Marine Monthly Magazine put it on the front cover so that they outed themselves as having this thing and touted it and had some artist renderings of it and yada yada. And then hilariously, 2 or 3 years later, the Air Force announces that they have it and pretend that they just got it and they're the only people and it's brand new, completely ignoring the fact that the Marines had already had it for 3 years.
And I found it interesting about this weapon that basically after your skin heats up and they turn it off, it makes everybody laugh.
I hadn't heard that one, but
I saw a demonstration of it, and it was just amazing. I mean, they would get very hot, they'd back off, and then they were all laughing.
I do remember seeing something like 60 Minutes or something carrying this thing. So that's what we mean when we say an electromagnetic weapon. That is, electromagnetics is radio frequency. And there are lots of these things out there. Some they have admitted to, some they haven't admitted to. Another one is an artificial electromagnetic pulse generator. They discovered in 1964 with the Johnston Atoll nuke shot that there was something called the EMP, the electromagnetic pulse, which was a pulse of electromagnetic energy that came out from an atomic detonation, and it fried out the electronics of everything associated with it. And so you've probably heard about hardened equipment, hardened silos, etc. The hardening is not to prevent the shockwave from crashing it. It's designed to prevent the EMP from crashing the electronics. And from the moment they discovered that atom bombs produced EMPs, they've been trying to artificially make one. And the Air Force has been working on a gizmo they called Hermes. And Hermes 3 was deployed in Gulf War 1. And they had a battlefield-ready EMP generator in Gulf War 1. And there's a great deal of debate as to whether or not HAARP is capable of being an EMP generator. And I am quite convinced that it is. Again, when you heat up the ionosphere by several thousand degrees, that blows apart the molecules of the atmosphere and converts them from a gas to a plasma, which is an electrically charged gas. And because it's at the top of the atmosphere, that electrically charged gas goes out into space. As a side note, this means every time they use HAARP, they throw away a chunk of our atmosphere, which I think is a pretty dumb thing to do. So this plume of electrically charged gas goes out into space, and it keeps going out until it runs into something to stop it, which is the magnetic lines of force of the Earth's magnetic field. And it hits the magnetic lines of force, gets trapped between the lines of force, and spreads out, forming a shield. HAARP is a ground-based Star Wars weapon system that is that generates this shell of electrically charged particles that anything electronic moving through would be disrupted or destroyed by. So it could be used to fry out passing spy satellites or incoming ICBMs.
When you mention a plume of electrically charged gas or a plasma, again, this reminds me of the pictures that Judy Wood shows of the World Trade Center Towers 1 and 2 immediately before they came down, when she said the towers were being, quote, lathered up.
It does sound very similar. Again, there are a lot of variations on this theme, and I hesitate to say HAARP did it, but HAARP-like technology is under development in a lot of different labs for a lot of different purposes and a lot of different applications, and there may indeed have been something HAARP-like used on the towers.
And
yeah,
what would a positive example of HAARP usage be?
What would a positive example of RTH be? Well, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, was given the job of completing HAARP, and they listed four things that they had done with HAARP. And if I had a copy of the book in front of me, I had to run to another building to get to this phone, so I didn't bring my notes with me. But in the there's a in Weather Warfare, there's an extensive chapter updating HAARP, and in there I quote verbatim the DARPA webpage, and they list four things that they have done with HAARP, which includes the first item is two separate different things under one bullet, which is the generation, the ionospheric generation of ELF and VLF for subsurface communications, and at the same time, what they call the reduction of population densities of radioactive particles in the radiation belts for safe spacecraft operations. So they put a smiley face on this generating a plume of plasma, and they point out that this plasma goes out until it hits the magnetic lines of force, which is the inner Van Allen belt, and overburdens the Van Allen belt and forces it to precipitate, to rain out, which makes it which reduces how much radiation is in the belt, so you can shoot spacecraft through it. Though I can assure you there has not been an environmental impact study done of what happens when you rain hard radiation back to Earth by this technique.
Can you explain what the VLF is?
Well, radio frequency spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, runs from 0 hertz per minute, or 0 hertz, you know, it's measured in hertz. It runs from very, very long radio waves that are hundreds of miles long to radio waves that are microscopic, billionths of a second long, up at X-rays and gamma rays. So there's the electromagnetic spectrum includes what we use for radio, television, visible light, microwaves, and hard radiation, gamma, alpha, etc. And ELF is at extremely low frequency, is the lowest frequency from 0 to 10 hertz. And then there's ultra low and very low and low frequency, and then high frequency, and very high frequency, and ultra high frequency. And if you have a TV set with two dials on it, one is VHF and one is UHF. Those are the TV bands. And above TV is microwave, which cooks your TV dinner. And above that, you have the stuff that gets generated in atomic piles.
Yeah. Again, be a little provocative, a lot of people are wondering what happened with Hurricane Katrina and what happened with the Christmas tsunami of 2004 right next to Indonesia. Do you have an opinion as to whether, number one, it's possible that some of these weapons were used to trigger these events, or number two, whether they actually were?
I do indeed have an opinion, and it's my opinion based on several decades of research is a little different from the what you get in internet scuttlebutt. Let's go back to HAARP's completion date. HAARP was officially completed in 2007, but by BAE Systems, the contractor who built it. It was officially completed in 2006 by DARPA, who had the contract to hire, who had the authority to hire BAE Systems to build it. And then the observers on the ground paying attention to HAARP saw that throughout 2005, each day there would be an hour or two of testing of the radio frequency in the evening. So what they figured was going on was that during the day they put up the antennas and the transmitters and wired them up, and then at night they tested the wiring to see if what they'd done during the day had actually worked or not. And they completed doing this daily testing a few days before Thanksgiving 2005, which was somewhat after Katrina. 2005 was the worst hurricane season ever, largest number of named storms, largest number of Category 4 and 5 storms ever to make landfall, which included Katrina and Rita and Wilma and so forth. So the likelihood of HAARP being involved in that is fairly slim. However, what happened the next year? If you remember, during 2005, the weather pundits were saying that the 2006 season was going to be even worse. And what happened? Nothing.
Nothing.
And 2007? Nothing. And 2008? Nothing. What I believe happened, and I can't prove this, it's speculation relegated to the last chapter of the Weather Warfare book, was I believe what happened is that they rushed HAARP into completion 2 years ahead of schedule so that they could bring it online in time for the 2006 hurricane season. And if you remember, during the 2006 hurricane season, a couple of days before the hurricane season began, a mysterious, anomalous high-pressure dome appeared over the southeastern United States and stayed over the southeastern United States until a few days after the official end of the hurricane season, and then this dome mysteriously dissipated. That dome worked like a rubber bumper on a pinball machine, and hurricanes like pinballs crashed into it and bounced off and were thrown off safely back out to sea. This happened in 2006 and again 2007, and it seems to be occurring again so far in 2008. I believe that the pundits said in 2006 that the mysterious high pressure dome, which had never before been seen, was caused by El Nino. 2007, no El Nino, still have the dome. 2008, no El Nino, still have the dome. Now you might be thinking, well, if HAARP is used as a hurricane shield, why aren't they, saying, hey, we did it, we saved the coast, we're heroes. Well, look at what's going on under that high pressure dome. Drought, wildfires, destruction of property, death to shut-ins from the heat, etc. If they were to take responsibility for saving the coast, they would also admit responsibility for frying the interior. And they don't dare do that, so they're just keeping mum on the subject.
So what would be their motivation for having done that? Just as an experiment, or
to
benefit,
was,
or to...
2006 was an election year. Election year politics generally are anything that's good reflects well on the status quo. Those who wish to remain in power will do whatever it takes to make things good, at least for the few weeks before the election. I think that's the long and the short of it, is that it was an election year and they pulled out all the stops to try and retain power. Once they had it up and running and it worked, they went, hey, cool, look at that, and did it again. And now it's an election year again, a crucial election year, and they're doing it again.
And they would be the military or the people that are actually working with HAARP?
Well, I don't think it's either of them. As I point out in my HAARP book, the military follows orders. My big complaint with the previous book on HAARP, which was by Nick Begich and Gene Manning, Angels Don't Play This HAARP, is that they looked at all the science behind HAARP. They really did a fine job on what, where, when, how, and left out who and why. All they really did was prove this is a military project, and then say civilian good, military bad. It's a military project, therefore it's bad. We're done. And I went, no. The military is like a bulldozer. You know, it follows orders. There's a driver. The driver, and the driver has his work order. Somebody tells him what to do with the bulldozer. The military is a blunt instrument who follows orders. It's got to be above the military. It's got to be the people who give the military orders have got to be the people who are really behind the program.
So who is funding HARP?
That's a good question. What we know is that the primary funding is from the U.S. Navy. And the U.S. Navy gets it from primarily from Senate appropriations. The Congress tells the Navy, okay, you can spend this money. The Navy then gives it, doled it out to DARPA. DARPA then doled it out to BAE Systems. BAE Systems then doled it out to subcontractors to put the thing together. And over the last 20 years, they've spent around $300 million on it, which for a DOD project is ridiculously cheap.
Okay. So that brings us over to Banda Aceh in Indonesia and the big tsunami, which was triggered, of course, by a big earthquake that happened under the ocean.
Right. You know, I studied that at great length, and I'm actually still researching it. It didn't end up in the weather warfare book because I haven't completed my research on it yet. There is a lot of conflicting indicators. There's a lot of conflicting evidence as to what happened in what order, and what we know there was a large seismic event. The question is, what triggered the large seismic event? And in weather warfare, I have a whole chapter. In HARP, I have a sub-chapter on earthquakes on demand. We know the science is clear that there are half a dozen ways that humans can inadvertently, unintentionally create earthquakes. And we know from that there have been a couple of intentional earthquakes created by humans, one of which was Project Faultless, which Project Faultless was the late 1960s. You may know that the Nevada test site is about 90 miles from Las Vegas, and for the first years of the Cold War era, the bombs were set off above ground. And in the 50s, it was a big deal, a big tourist draw to go to Vegas and see a nuke shot. And there were atomic cocktails and atomic hairdos and whatnot. As the bombs got bigger, there was the test ban treaty, and that put all the bombs underground, and then they got really big. And as the bombs got bigger, the buildings in Vegas rocked and shook more. And at one point, Howard Hughes, who owned half a dozen casinos in Vegas, got rattled, quite literally. And he'd had enough of frightened tourists and broken glass and ordered the Nevada test site to move. And Hughes actually had enough oomph, had enough power to get them to agree, yeah, we can't do any more really big ones here. We need a site far away from humans. And they did eventually end up on an island in the Kamchatkas, or an island in the Aleutians, off of Kamchatka. But they initially tried central Nevada, and they decided to intentionally place the biggest bomb, and it turned out to be the biggest bomb ever detonated in the continental United States, intentionally on a fault line to see if it would induce an earthquake. Of course, they assumed it wouldn't, so they called it Project Faultless. But they were dead wrong. And not only did it set off the fault zone it was on, it set off one on the other side of the valley. There were disruptions of between 10 and 15 feet along both of those fault lines, dropping the valley floor by an average of 8 feet, at which point they realized, oops, and moved it off. But that is a well-established, well-documented case of humans intentionally creating an earthquake and subsequent damage. My contention is that if you can do it accidentally the first time, you can do it intentionally the second time. And we know there's half a dozen different ways of doing these things. And that that's from mechanical, but not from electromagnetics. And there are a number of electromagnetic indicators. And I give the Tenseng earthquake that killed 650,000 people in China as an example. Dr. Andreich Puharich was convinced that that earthquake was generated by electromagnetic means, and part of the evidence of this was that half an hour before the earthquake, there were wild lights in the sky, and vegetables growing in the ground were fried on one side as if subjected to a very high heat. There was a recent earthquake in China with exactly the same phenomena. And these days we have YouTube, and if you go to YouTube, you can actually see the wild colors in the sky 15 minutes before the earthquake happened.
And what would be the cause of those then? Could you pin it down to a certain...
You know, this is the great thing about using natural systems as a weapon. Mother Nature gives great credible deniability. It's extremely difficult to trace back where to even establish that a weapon was used, much less where the weapon was located when it was used.
Yeah.
So there's no way to really trace these back to their origin. They just kind of happen, and you have to see what's out there in regard to where they might point.
Exactly. What I've come to is that if you can find no natural explanation for it, then you may be looking at an unnatural explanation. As I said, this anomalous high pressure dome over the southeastern United States is now in its third year, and it's never existed before. This thing has never been seen before. There is no natural explanation for why a high pressure dome would park itself over a region of the country for an extended period of time.
Well, we do have the Bermuda highs, which are just in that area, and they flow back and forth over the continent and the ocean. But what you're saying was anomalous was that it just stayed in one place?
Exactly. It stayed in one place conveniently for the entire length of the hurricane season, 2006-2007.
One thing that was brought up by some people that I know that was kind of following that event was that weather pattern had kind of parked itself right along where the proposed Trans-Texas corridor was, and
exactly.
Inundated.
That was big scuttlebutt on the internet last year. The high pressure dome in 2006 was huge and didn't allow moisture hardly at all onto the North American continent. They seem to have fine-tuned it a bit and reduced it in size. So then, 2007, it stopped the Atlantic hurricanes, but coming up from the Yucatan is what the locals call the Yucatan Express,
uh-huh.
Which is moisture comes up around the western side of the western shore of the Gulf of Mexico, and up from the Yucatan, up southern Texas, and then into the southeast. And the smaller dome stopped the Yucatan Express over central Texas and dumped rain right dead over the spot where they are planning to build this North American free trade superhighway. It's supposed to be 16 lanes wide, 8 in each direction, right smack up the center of Texas. And there had just been some politics on this, and that the Texas government had initially said that they were going to use eminent domain to take this property, and the Texas legislature passed laws making it a whole lot harder for the administration to just grab this property. And then immediately thereafter, there was conveniently all this rain and flooding, leading many people to speculate that it was intentional to flood out the homeowners so the government could pick up the property pennies on the dollar.
Well, isn't there also some speculation on some of the flooding that took place in Iowa this year in the same note?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised. I haven't heard it, but I haven't gone out looking for internet scuttlebutt recently. And this, you know, this sort of thing comes up repeatedly. What was it, 10, 15 years? Yeah, 10, 12 years ago, there was drought and wildfire in Idaho, Montana, in the same areas where there was very active militia movements and patriot groups. And there was a lot of patriot groups saying that they're trying to burn us out.
We had something similar happen in Colorado in regard to Pinyon Canyon. The government went in and wanted to buy up a bunch of land, and the owners and citizens of the county said no, and within about a week it was on fire.
Mm, exactly.
But again...
It's very difficult because Mother Nature gives great credible deniability. You can say it was... you can say anything and pretty much get away with it because it's extremely difficult to prove anything along these lines.
Yet you have.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that myself, and I teach a course in climatology and have done for a long time, and know how very complex our weather and climate systems are. In fact, they're enormously complex. So I would like to, if you could maybe explain in a kind of a nutshell how the HAARP weapon could maneuver this high-pressure dome to a particular spot and keep it there.
I got to tell you, I'm not a meteorologist. I'm not scientifically versed in that. In fact, the science I know is I'm a geologist, and particularly volcanism and plate tectonics. So if you want to talk about igneous intrusions and subduction zones, I'm with you. But when it comes to atmospheric dynamics, I just have to take what scientists tell me is what they say it is, and I have to take their word for it or not, as the case may be.
I'll just throw out then that the whole science of chaos and chaos theory comes out of the study of meteorology. This idea of sensitive dependence on initial conditions, that a butterfly can flap his wings in Iowa and this can spawn a hurricane off the Atlantic Ocean. That there's a cascade of unexpected consequences from very, very small forcing factors can cause unexpected results, so that it's impossible for meteorologists to predict the weather after 5 days. Because
exactly.
Then there's so many of these things that can happen and go in so many different directions that statistically they can't make good predictions after 5 days. So as a person who teaches climatology, I would be very interested to know how the HAARP system could move these major pressure systems around and guide them. I think it's possible in the sense that, I've read that they can move hurricanes. Well, hurricanes are low-pressure systems. What you're talking about is a high-pressure system.
Right.
So,
but these
are responding to temperature variations on the surface, which then cause relative wind speeds. So what you're dealing with is a system where you have differences in heat, you have differences in wind, you have differences in air pressure, and then this becomes a guiding mechanism for storms. So it's very complex, and I sure would like to know how HAARP can affect that system.
Well, some of that is given in the HAARP patents, and I give the very first HAARP patent at the back of the HAARP book. Dr. Bernard Eastland led a team at APTI, which was originally ARCO Power Technologies Incorporated, and then they realized that putting the ARCO in the name kind of gave away a little too much and changed it to Advanced Power Technologies Incorporated. And Dr. Eastland and his team came up with the 12 basic patents that HAARP is based on. But of course the people at HAARP say, oh no, that's not us, because that's a ground-based armored weapon system, and we're not, so we're not it. But the proof that they are those patents is that the company that owns the patents has changed hands repeatedly, and each time the ownership of the company changes, the ownership of the intellectual property changes, and the new owners get the contract. APTI got the initial contract to build HAARP. They got bought by E-Systems. E-Systems then got the contract. E-Systems was then bought out by Raytheon. Raytheon got the contract. Raytheon then spun off its E-Systems division and sold it to BAE Systems North America, who then got the contract, which I think is proof that indeed those patents are the basis of HARP. And in those patents, it describes how the weather can be manipulated, particularly how the jet stream can be moved around. A major science magazine, and I wish I could remember which one now, I think it was either Science or Nature, in 2003 noted that in 2002 there was a dogleg in the jet stream immediately above the HARP facility, which resulted in a swarm of out-of-season tornadoes in Florida.
Okay. That's a long way away.
Yes, it is.
But if you move the jet stream in one place, it'll have to move elsewhere, I presume.
Exactly. So. It's the downstream effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And with HARP in Gakona, Alaska, in southeastern Alaska, that puts it at the weather front door of North America. The jet stream normally is very near to Gakona, and that's the start point over North American weather. So if you can fiddle with the weather over HARP, you can fiddle with the weather over all of the North American continent.
Yeah, and just for our listeners, the position of the jet stream is it moves. It kind of has a stability for a month or two or three, and then it changes its configuration. But the reason it's important is it becomes the guiding kind of the pathway for storms, the storm track, the mid-latitude storm track, where you get westerly winds coming and are just circling the globe from west to east. This is what's called the mid-latitude storm track, and that basically follows the contours, whatever they are, of that particular season of the jet stream, which is why Colorado might get a lot of snow one year and why it might not. The position of the jet stream would affect that.
Exactly. Now, I point out in some articles I've written after weather warfare came out that there is strong evidence that what's going on in North Korea, that is the prolonged North Korean drought, is the result of Chinese manipulation of the weather. China has had an army of what they call weather managers, and at the moment, the Chinese government says they have 37,000 full-time weather managers working on the weather over over China. And weather management there is a blend of mostly cloud seeding techniques to increase precipitation, suppress drought, and some other techniques for dispersing fog from airports. You know, the Summer Olympics are due to open in Beijing in a few days, and this is the height of the rainy season. And Beijing has been claiming since for the last 6 or 8 months that they're going to have, that they can promise perfect weather on opening day. And that's because they have been working in weather management for more than a decade, and they're actually going to be using a technique that was pioneered by the Russians. As you know, the Russians hold their annual May Day parade at the height of the most unstable period in May in weather in the USSR. It should rain or snow on the parade, but it never does because the Soviets figured out a way to prevent it from raining at least for a few hours. And I maintain that what's been going on for the last decade or so is that the Chinese weather managers have been gleefully stealing North Korea's rain and getting away with it.
Isn't there a statement?
This is one of the great unsettled debates in the United States. For the first scientific manipulation creation of artificial rain was in the 1890s. In fact, the first patent granted in the United States for artificial rainmaking was granted in 1880. To a United States general, so the military has been in on this thing literally since day one. During the U.S. Civil War, a number of people observed that great battles were often followed by great rainstorms. Now today we know that this was caused by the smoke and dust of battle working as nucleating particles creating particles that the atmospheric moisture attached itself to, and so grew heavy and fell as raindrops. At the time, a general who led an artillery battery thought that perhaps it was the concussions from his explosives, the pressure changes that caused the rain. And he patented a technique for making rain based on the concussion theory, which in 1890, the United States Department of Agriculture tested. And they sent a team to the Steak Plains of Texas, where they imitated a battle with aerial explosions and ground explosions, and got rain. And the head of the experiment sent back to Washington a memo that under the right circumstances, it was indeed possible to artificially induce rain. And with that the official federal stamp of approval, in the 1890s, when there was a massive drought across the western plains at Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Nebraska, etc., a veritable army of rainmakers appeared in the 1890s, and many of them got success. Many of them got rain. And from that day to this day, there have been a number of points debated in this, one of which is this an acceptable practice from God's point of view? A lot of people think that the heavens are God's territory and that it is impertinent and ill-conceived for mankind to meddle with God's affairs and try to make the heavens do things. In fact, just a couple of months ago, back in February, there was a Water Management Board meeting in the Texas Panhandle, and they have been hiring weather managers in the U.S. for a decade or two to precipitation enhancement and hail suppression, and they were the meeting was to just rubber stamp this year's operating budget, and a bunch of farmers and housewives showed up and demanded that they not do it, that they not use scientific methods to control the weather because it was meddling with God's affairs, and the bureaucrats and scientists on the board were deeply puzzled as to why these people had this seemingly Middle Ages attitude towards things. And there's been a lot of legal questions here. If I make it rain where I am and you're downwind of me and it doesn't rain where you are, did I steal your rain? How much of your rain did I steal? How much damages are you owed by me? And these are unresolved questions that have been tied up in the U.S. courts for 130 years.
Jerry, we'll be back after station identification and sponsorship.
Okay, you're listening to KAGN LPFM Radio, 106.9 Salida, Colorado, community-supported radio. And the views expressed on this program are those of myself and my guests and don't necessarily reflect the views of the KAGN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. And support for KAGN and TruthQuest brought to you by Kevin Barnes, agent for Land Property, Inc.'s Little River Ranch, offering beautiful land home packages with underground utilities and river access just 3 miles from historic downtown Salida. Find out more at ColoradoHomeProperties.com or call Kevin at 719-207-0858. And tonight on TruthQuest with Melody and my co-host Katie O'Brien and Dr. Eric Carlstrom is our guest, Jerry E. Smith. Okay?
So this weather experimentation has been going on since the 1890s, and
yes,
now they have perfected it into something they call HARP, and they're actually using radio waves in regard to sending wherever they want to send it. What is the effect on our ocean when this is coming from submarines?
That's a darn good question, and I really do not believe anybody has the answer to it. The scientists involved in HARP insist there is no effect. And I've been asked hundreds of times if the beachings of marine mammals is related to it. And as best I can tell, no. The beachings of marine mammals is mostly related to the new generation of sonars. And the new generation of sonars were first being tested right about the time my HARP book came out at the end of the 90s. And this stuff is just, it's unconscionable. It's insane. The United States government should be arrested for what they're doing. To give you an idea, if you've ever stood at the end of a runway and had a 747 come in 1,000 feet over your head, multiply that by 100,000, and that's how loud these sonars are. In one experiment in, I think it was 96 or 97, a submarine off the coast of California near San Diego pinged, and it was heard at Diego Garcia, an island in the center of the Indian Ocean on the opposite side of the planet. In 2000, I spoke at a conference in the Bahamas during a time when the U.S. Navy was doing war games off the Bahamas, and they were using these sonars, and whales and dolphins and manatees were beaching themselves by the hundreds. And marine biologists examining their bodies discovered that their internal cavities were exploded from the intensity of the sound. These animals were climbing out of the water to get out of the noise.
Oh, my goodness. So you might
well, Jerry, you I'm trying to find out or learn from you what exactly effects that you think can be attributable to the HARP and the weather modification from our government, and whether these have been primarily beneficial, and whose interests have been served by the use of these techniques.
You know, I don't have a solid, simple pat answer to that question. This is an area I've now been researching for a decade, and I still have more questions than answers on this. What we know about this thing is that it seems simple, is that it seems innocuous, it seems like it is just a research station. And indeed, in June of this year, Popular Science magazine ran an article on what HARP is, in which they said, oh, there are these detractors, and they say it can do this, that, and the other thing, but it's just nonsense. HARP is just a simple little research station. That's all it is. And I got a one-sentence diss in it, in which they quoted me and made me, they said I was an extreme skeptic, which I thought was kind of hilarious. But what is HARP researching? This is, I think, the key to understanding what it's about. Yes, HARP, I agree, HARP is a research station. But what is HARP researching? They want you to think it's researching atmospheric dynamics, that it's characterizing how the atmosphere works. No. They finished doing that a decade or two ago. Now we know how we now understand the dynamics of the atmosphere. We now understand how the ionosphere works. What they're researching is, how can we put that to use? HARP is about application. HARP is about technology. HARP is about what we can do with this. And who's funding HARP? This was a question that came up earlier. HARP is being funded out of the Department of Defense budget. The science that's being done is being done to further Department of Defense goals. What does the Department of Defense want to do? It wants to win wars. It's really simple. So if you are researching for the DOD, and you're looking to further DOD desires, you're looking to make weapons or things that make weapons more powerful or useful. Or it's HARP is a oh God, I hate it when I go blank. Weapons, it's a force multiplier. Indeed, there's an Air Force white paper called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025, in which they look long and hard at what HARP is doing, which is called ionospheric enhancement. You gotta love this. Ionospheric enhancement, they're blowing up the molecules of the atmosphere. Only the military would think that blowing up something enhances it. And this, what HARP does is ionospheric enhancement, and it's being done for the DOD, which means it is a force multiplier. What they're doing is researching how the atmosphere can be used as a weapon. That's called weaponization. HARP is a research station whose research is how to weaponize the atmosphere. Now, call me old-fashioned, but I think that's a bad idea.
So
and
this
especially
you think
when
has
they
to
don't
do
even
with...
realize that they did this test when you were in the Bahamas, and that mammals were literally beaching themselves. They don't seem to make any correlation between the two.
Right. In fact, while I was there, it was big news on the local TV radio newspapers, and that the Bahamian government was demanding the U.S. government stop, and saying the U.S. government was responsible for all these beachings. And the U.S. government, the U.S. Navy, said, no, we're not responsible, and we're not going to stop. If you don't like it, it's your problem. Go bye. So the U.S. military has an incredibly high-handed approach to everything. The U.S. State Department has an incredibly high-handed approach to everything. Words like hubris barely describe what's going on with these folks. If you've talked with these scientists, you will come away with an impression of incredible arrogance. These guys think they know everything. These guys think they can do anything. And yet, as the good professor has pointed out, we do not understand all the systems. We do not know all the feedbacks. We cannot predict that which way the wind is going to blow from the flapping of a butterfly's wings.
So you would say this is definitely part of Strategic Defense Initiative or Star Wars funding, but that the exact application remains. What's that?
That's what it came out of.
Yeah. So it would be part then of a series of strategies to control space, so that you can control the planet, basically.
Yes, yes. An example of this is Operation Popeye, Project Popeye during during the Vietnam War, was the use of weather as a weapon. This came to public consciousness in 1971 in Jack Anderson's syndicated column. I think it was in the Washington Post, the New York Times, or some such. And Anderson revealed that the U.S. government was using weather as a weapon in Vietnam. Senator Claiborne Pell, Democrat, Rhode Island, launched an investigation a few months later in 1972 and called then-Secretary of Defense Melvin Laird to answer. And Laird lied to Congress. Laird told Pell, oh, no, that's just nonsense. That's just science fiction. You can't use weather as a weapon. We're certainly not doing that. We're the good guys. We wouldn't do that. 2 years later, a private letter from Laird got leaked to the press in which he admitted that Project Popeye was real and had been ongoing for a couple of years, and that he had lied to Congress. Pell reconvened his investigation, but there was a bit of a problem in that Laird had left the DOD and was now working as a private lawyer, as counsel to Richard Nixon, who was fighting for his political life in the aftermath of the Watergate break-ins. Pell did get the Pentagon to agree to secret closed-door sessions. In those secret sessions, the DOD admitted that Project Popeye was real, had been ongoing from 1968 to 72, that they had expended 47,000 units of cloud seeding materials over four countries, North and South Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, the latter two in violation of international law because they were neutral, at an operational cost of about $21.6 million. hotel then demanded to know what else they were doing, and they revealed a shocking laundry list of insane experiments they were working on, including intentionally melting Arctic ice and intentionally thinning out the ozone layer over the enemy so as to sicken the enemy populace through increased exposure to solar radiation. This just devastated Pell, and he became what today would be called the poster child for a movement to create an international treaty banning weather as a weapon. And that treaty, and I'm hoping you can give me the name of it because I never can quite get it right.
The convention?
Yeah, that's it.
Go ahead.
Convention on the Prohibition of Military or Any Other Hostile Use of Environmental Modification Techniques. Appendix
right.
A
also
of your
known
book
as
on
the
what
ENMA Treaty. And this is hilarious. The militaries of the world realized that once they had established that it was illegal to engage in ENMOD, they struck the word ENMOD from the vocabularies. And if you try doing a Google search in ENMOD, you will only find discussions and papers on the treaty. Nowhere else does that phrase appear, and yet environmental modification was a major ongoing event. Indeed, in the United States, the federal government, prior to signing the treaty, was spending between $40 and $140 million a year on developing environmental modification technologies and had over 700 degreed scientists working on it. After we signed the treaty, the federal government went to zero, and those jobs all went away. And we're led to believe that Uncle Sam said, can't do that anymore. No, what happened is, you may have heard this phrase recently, civilian contractors. They took it off budget and beyond congressional scrutiny by moving it to private companies. One of the biggest of which is Weather Modification Incorporated of Fargo, North Dakota. To give you an idea of as proof of this, in 2005, one of the senior scientists at Weather Modification Incorporated went on Art Bell's Coast to Coast AM radio show and outed himself as having been one of the senior scientists on Operation Popeye. So after Popeye got revealed, the U.S. government found itself caught with its fingers in the cookie jar, signed this international treaty, and moved everything off budget where it is to this day. There are several pieces of legislation that are key to this. Quite a bit of scuttlebutt went around the internet in the last couple of years. Senator Kay Bailey Hutchinson introduced a bill called the Weather Modification. I listed in the book there. I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the book handy to read this off. The Weather Modification Authorization Act, is that what it was? That bill got through committee and went to the Senate calendar, and then died without being voted on because there was quite a ruckus raised over it. What this bill would have done would create a Weather Modification Advisory Board. And the Weather Modification Advisory Board was a classic example of foxes being asked to be put in charge of henhouse operations. The board would have been composed of just meteorologists, scientists, military and civilians who were already working in environmental modification, in weather modification technologies, and would not have included anybody affected by their operations. No insurance companies, no farmers would have any input on this thing. And that was seen as evil by some, and then other people just because they don't think man should be meddling in God's affairs were opposed to any sort of authorization of weather modification, thinking that if they could stop this bill, it wouldn't happen. But of course, it's been going on for 100+ years. That bill, after it died, got reintroduced with the slightest name change possible, it went from Weather Modification Advisory Board to Weather Mitigation Advisory Board, in which they jumped on the Al Gore boogeyman global warming bandwagon and decided, well, if we can't get authorization to modify the weather, we can get authorization to mitigate the effects of global warming and weather and so forth. And it was reintroduced, I believe, by Orrin Hatch, and is moving through the congressional machinery even as I speak. You can go to Thomas.gov to find out where it is right now. Thomas.gov is a service I think it's the Congressional Library, and it lists every bill in Congress and what its status is.
This is positively Orwellian. Weather Mitigation Advisory Board, you're going to mitigate the weather. Weather's been with us always, and it always will be with us, you know, so... In that phrase is loaded the implicit assumption that global warming is occurring and it's a disaster, when I don't think you can assume that based on the scientific evidence. But it's interesting.
Absolutely. In fact, I take a number of pot shots at global warming in weather warfare. I didn't get real deep into it because in weather warfare, I wanted to be only what I could prove. So, yeah, I do bring up a lot of conspiracy theories, and then I go through the science of what can be proved about those theories, and I pitch out a lot of theories as being clearly nonsense, and do support with good, mainstream, credible, somewhat reliable evidence that these theories are indeed true. This is actual fact. I tried not to go into theories without being able to nail the truth on these. And with global warming, it's very difficult to get to the truth on the subject.
Because it is so controversial, and because the system is so complex. I'm going to be working on a paper on that pretty soon, but I won't go there now. It would sure be interesting if you would talk a little bit about the potential for mind control that might be associated with HARP.
Right. That was actually the first thing that got my attention. I have been researching MKUltra and other government mind control projects since the mid-1970s. In 1976, I met Walter Boart, who wrote Operation Mind Control, which blew the whistle on a CIA program called MKUltra. And MKUltra is very real. It's not science fiction. It's not fantasy. It's not something invented by guys trying to sell books. The CIA was pulled into Congress, grilled about it. The head of the project, Dr. Stanley Gottlieb, you talk about arrogance. He flatly said to the congressman investigating him that their security clearance simply wasn't high enough for him to be able to answer any questions. So please just shut up and leave me alone. What they did find out was that MKUltra was 149 sub-projects being carried out in universities, hospitals, prisons, military bases, and it was engaged in doing a wide variety of searches for a variety of things. It began with a search for a truth serum during World War II and progressed from troop serum to a number of things, including electronic dissolution of memory, the creation of programmed assassins, hypnotically controlled soldiers, and just an incredible laundry list of bizarre things they were working on. So I became aware of it in 76 and had been researching it, you know, reading about it, being keenly interested in it from then on. And then in 1995, I read Begich and Manning's book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, in which they point out that the primary purpose of HARP is to bathe the world in ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves, at exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. And the light bulb went on over my head, and I went, oh my God. The HARP project was originally funded to do something called earth-penetrating tomography. Now, that's a brand new science. It did not exist before 1980. HARP is a type of device called an ionospheric heater because it heats the ionosphere by several thousand degrees. And there are about 20 other ionospheric heaters scattered around the planet today. The Max Planck Institute of Germany operates one in Tromsø, Norway. There are about six in the former Soviet Union. There's one at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. But none of them have the unique patented ability to focus the output from the field of antennas the way HARP does. So HARP is a one of a kind and of a type at the same time. And the earth penetrating tomography, there is another ionospheric heater in Alaska north of HARP called High Pass. And I can never remember what High Pass stands for. It's operated by the physics lab of the plasma physics lab of UCLA, and in the early 1990s, they used its ability to heat the ionosphere enough to generate this ELF, extremely low frequency radio waves, through the shattering of the molecules of the ionosphere, and used this flow of ELF that went deep underground to image an old mining tunnel outside of Fairbanks. And they were very excited about this and went to Congress and led, the United States Senate Military Appropriations Committee, led by Senator Ted Stevens, senior senator from Alaska at the time, to fund HARP, to fund a project to use this ionospherically generated ELF to locate and monitor enemy underground bases for the manufacture and launch of weapons of mass destruction. And indeed, initially in the HARP project, it was early on realized that it would take several years to build HARP, and the Senate suspended the funding. They stopped the funding to the Navy until the Navy agreed to a multi-year program to engage in earth-penetrating tomography to verify counter-proliferation treaty studies. And there was a hold up on the funding, and finally the Navy gave in and said, okay, we'll do it. And then the funding was cut loose, and it took another 10 years to build HARP. And curiously enough, in those 10 years, there has not been a single word in official HARP literature that they've ever done earth-penetrating tomography. There's no evidence whatsoever that HARP has ever done what the Senate funded it to do. Which leads me to ask the question, are they thumbing their nose at the U.S. Senate, or are they doing it and doing it so well they don't want the world to know what capabilities they really have and are just saying deliberately mum on the subject?
Can that not be used for, like, looking for resources like water or oil?
Exactly. It can be. Earth-penetrating tomography is currently being used to look for an awful lot of things, including lost cities and gold mines. A gold mine was just turned up by a satellite using this technique a few weeks ago. This is a breaking... a brand new science that is having lots and lots of new discoveries, lots and lots of new things being found with this. They think they found Sheba by satellite earth-penetrating tomography a couple of years ago. The thing about using ionospherically generated ELF to do this is that, again, With radio, the antenna has to be longer than the wave generated, and they want to do this in the lowest frequencies possible. And the lower the frequency, the longer the wave. And the Navy had a problem with communicating with deeply submerged submarines because regular radio doesn't penetrate very deep into the oceans. So they wanted something really, really long wave that would go really deep. And that's how the Navy and the Air Force came together to run this project, because the Air Force was charged with finding and monitoring enemy underground bases, and the Navy was trying to communicate with deeply submerged submarines. And they realized that with this, they could generate ELF that would penetrate, that would do both. And the thing that got my attention and scared me was that this ELF is at exactly the same frequency that the human brain works at. And having studied for 20 years how the intelligence community, there's an oxymoron for you, had been using this technology, had been searching for ways to win the hearts and minds by literally taking over the minds, I was very much convinced that my greatest fear is that HARP is exactly what they say it is. If HARP has no biologist, no psychologist, nobody involved in HARP has any clue how the human brain works. All the scientists working on HARP are atmospheric scientists and radio frequency scientists. They could inadvertently, accidentally create mental dysfunction, road rage, or fear, or across a huge section of the planet and not have a clue they're doing it. And of course, if there is a black ops, if there is a secret side to HARP, it may well be the ultimate mind control technique.
Could you speculate how it might be used?
I'm sorry?
Could you speculate how it might be used?
I do speculate on a couple of possible uses in the HARP book, where my two books are rather day and night. As I said earlier, Nick Begich and Gene Manning did a great job on what, where, when, how, but really did nothing on who and why. And so my HARP book, HARP, the Ultimate Weapon of the Conspiracy, is admittedly speculations on who might be, I state what HARP might be able to do, and then ask who would want to do that and why. And so I do give quite a bit, the book is mostly speculation based on the discernible science. And then weather warfare is the exact opposite, in which I stick to what I can prove about each of these things. So some of the ways that HARP, I speculate that HARP might be used for mind control, is one of the things they were coming up with, they had been researching heavily in the 50s, was how to use hypnosis for military purposes. And one of the things that was proposed by Dr. Estabrook, who was the head of hypnosis and psychology at Colgate University, he suggested to the U.S. military that they could create a sleeper army, that they could send a few hundred operatives, dentists. They send a couple hundred dentists into the enemy territory, and these dentists then do twilight sleep and put their patients under, and while the patients get dental work plus, they are hypnotized and given instructions on when they get the command to do something, like blow up the railroad station or put LSD in the drinking water. And the patient has no idea that they've been turned into a sleeper soldier. All that's needed is the command phrase to make them go out and do this. And the nice thing about dentistry is they tell you got to have your teeth checked twice a year. So twice a year you go back to get your teeth checked, and the command phrases and your instructions tinkered with, reinstalled, brought up to date, so that when you get the command phrase, you go off and do the thing. But of course, and Estabrook speculated that within a couple of years, a couple of hundred dentists could turn several hundred thousand people into sleeper agents without their knowing it. But of course, the problem is how do you launch a couple hundred thousand sleeper agents? We didn't, in the 50s, we didn't have demon dialers where every phone could be in a zip code, could be rung simultaneously. And that was one of the reasons why supposedly they didn't go forward with this technology. But there's speculations that HARP could be used to put words in people's heads. In Begich and Manning focus on a technique that today is called voice-to-skull, where a then friend of theirs, Pat Flanagan, when he was a teenager, came up with a device that could make deaf people hear through using a modulated sound waves. And after I read their book, I went looking for this stuff, and I found three or four more patents for devices for putting words in people's heads. And then after the book came out, I found another three or four. I mean, this is well patented. People like Frey and Chaffetz were working on this with military contracts at places like Walter Reed. This is well documented that voice to skull is indeed real. Some of the people who hear voices are not crazy. They really are hearing voices. And I speculate that if HARP is capable, if HARP can be tuned in such a way as to put words in people's heads, then you could create your sleeper army, and then using HARP or something like HARP, you could then put the command phrase into all their heads simultaneously, and they all go off and do their ordained fifth column work for us, and they blow up all the railroad tracks and put LSD in the drinking water, and we drive in and take over.
So basically, it would be putting words in the head versus images.
That's one thing. By the images, you brought up another thing. There has been internet speculation for decades about something called Project Bluebeam, and I've never been able to verify that Project Bluebeam is real, but a lot of people think it is. And Project Bluebeam is alleged to be a NASA program for how the New World Order could take over the world. And this was through either faking the rapture or faking alien invasion. And the idea here was that if you could simultaneously around the world either convince people that God was talking to them or that aliens were invading the Earth, you could create a global government virtually overnight. With the faking the rapture, pretty simple. If you could put emotions into people, make them feel that that something wonderful was taking place, and paint the sky with images of the local god or goddess, and put words in their head saying, the moment is fulfilled, I am here, and my agents on Earth are the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers or the Bushes, and follow their commands, thank you very much, you would be able to convert the more religious members of the community over to their dictates. And the other was alien invasion. Reagan had repeatedly said that if the peoples of the world thought we were being invaded by a common enemy, the nations of the world would work together to fight that enemy, even if it was imaginary. And so there is some speculation that if you could paint the sky with images, you might be able to confuse people into thinking we were being invaded by aliens, even if we weren't, and be able to call for a global government to fight the non-existent menace.
Are you aware that the firemen in their manuals, it's chapter 13, are now trained for alien invasion?
No, I didn't know that. That's hilarious.
Well, it's chapter 13. They say they don't really work a lot with it, but it's there in the manual in regard to how they should show up. And then my question is, well, how are they going to medically treat aliens that are maybe injured?
That's a good question. I wonder if there are alien EMT schools out there.
You sound skeptical about the whole alien business.
I am, and this is an odd point for me in that I was the executive director of the National UFO Museum in Reno, Nevada in the early 90s. And what had happened was, while researching what became my second book, Secrets of the Holy Lance, The Spear of Destiny in History and Legend, I'd run into books about Nazi disc aircraft. And a buddy of mine, who was something of a mad scientist, insisted that he could build one if I could get him the blueprints. So I went off, I naively assumed, well, there must be a UFO museum out there somewhere where I can just ask with blueprints. And, of course, there wasn't one. So being one of those sort of people who believe that if you want something done right, do it yourself, I started one. Our logo was a Nazi disc aircraft. And so I've been researching Nazi UFOs, man-made UFOs, for almost 20 years now. And as the head of the UFO Museum, I read a great deal of UFO books and talked to a great number of ufologists, and I've spoken at many UFO conferences, and there are a lot of theories out there. The nuts and bolts bugbear from out there is just one of dozens of theories of what this phenomena is. And I think it's the least well-supported from scientific evidence of all the theories. There's a couple of them I kind of lean towards, particularly the Earth lights theory, which is that, as you know, crystals, when pressed, when put under pressure, will emit a flow of electricity. That's called piezoelectricity, and this can produce not just electrical phenomena, but optical phenomena. There have been mountain peak discharges recorded throughout human history. I think there's a good chance that some of the lights in the sky that are thought of as UFOs are in fact piezoelectric phenomena. I lean towards the, rather than extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional. Frontier theoretical physics right now is pretty much agreed that there are more than the four dimensions that humans normally view. The debate is not if there are multiple dimensions, it's how many there are. And depending on which school of physics you talk to, there's either 6 or 7 or 9 or 11 or 14 dimensions. And I suspect that that the majority of UFO phenomena we're seeing is either advanced aircraft or extra-dimensional activities.
And by extra-dimensional, what do you mean?
That what we're seeing is something that is perfectly terrestrial, but is from inhabits a different domain of space-time than where we are normally.
So if there are 13 dimensions going on here and we see 4, you would say that they're from one of the other 9?
Yeah, or 1 or 3 or 7 of the other 9.
Okay.
So about your MK Ultra, what is the most significant things that you feel came out of that research?
I can just barely hear you.
On that MK Ultra, what is the most significant things you feel came out of that research?
Well, from their point of view or my point of view?
Yours.
Yeah. From my point of view, I realized that the government lies to us constantly, that there's a whole lot of stuff going on that the government is engaged in, that the government is engaged in criminal activity on a scale inconceivable to the writers of CSI. That our government and probably every government is in one facet or another a criminal activity.
In regard to HARP, basically you mentioned China, the prior Soviet Union, and the United States. In regard to actually having something like this. And then you also mentioned Germany and Norway.
Right. Well, the Max Planck Institute, and they were also involved in mind control. The Max Planck Institute was the center of one of the major centers of Nazi science. They operate an ionospheric heater at Tromsø, Norway. So there are a lot of players in this. There are a lot of projects. One of the things I try to point out in weather warfare is that there has been, for 20 years now, HAARP has been the boogeyman that people, whenever something it goes wrong, whenever there is a bump in the night, people have been saying HAARP did it, and they've claimed HAARP has done virtually everything in the last 20 years. The problem is that's because that's the one dot. You know, we like to connect dots, and that's the one dot most people have. So they connect that dot to whatever problem they're trying to solve. But there are lots of other dots out there that we know nothing about. That there are, at any given moment, millions of scientific projects running in the United States. Every organization, every university, every college, every private research company are running dozens or hundreds of programs. And most of these we've never heard of, most of these we never will hear of. And yet there is tens of thousands of new weapon systems being tinkered with within 100 miles of your home at this very moment.
Was there any particular place that came out being the spearhead of the MKUltra project?
I'm sorry?
Was there any place that ended up being the spearhead of where the MKUltra project was coming from?
Yeah, there were about four centrals, and I don't remember any of them now. I have a lengthy section on the history of mind control in the HAARP book, and I give the four central funding points from which the 149 projects were funded, and I don't remember any of them offhand. I haven't read that chapter in 8 years.
I think one is in Toronto, Canada. McGill University.
Yes.
Ewan Cameron conducted lots of...
Yes.
Ewan
Cameron is an amazingly weird... this guy did something that he called de-patterning, in which he kept people locked in padded rooms, prevented them from getting any sleep, running a variety of bizarre drugs on them, not allowing them to go to the bathroom, playing loud music or other intensely painful audios on them to the point where their brains literally shattered, and he could make out of the putty that was left in their heads virtually anything he wanted. And he thought this was a wonderful thing, and the people who he did it to thought it was a horrible thing and succeeded in suing him. And he and the CIA and McGill University and the Canadian government, a bunch of other people, ended up coughing up millions of dollars in civil suits.
You know, I'm just reading a book now by Naomi Klein called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, and she talks about how, you know, under the Chicago School of Milton Friedman, all the Chicago boys, which includes Don Rumsfeld and a lot of neocons, they've been using this kind of economic shock therapy where you erase the slate and rebuild the economy of a local country along the lines that you want, using terrorist attacks, using natural disasters, using a war. And she actually traces that back to the experiments that Ewan Cameron ran in Toronto at McGill University, and saying that the CIA, with its MKUltra, was trying to take what they learned from how to deprogram a person to create this blank slate and then rebuild that personality. They've taken that same mindset and tried to do it with entire countries, entire regions, again with
major shocks to the system, such as whether they actually pull it off, such as the coup in Chile in 1973 that was organized by Nixon and Kissinger, or whether it was perhaps accidental, an act of nature like Hurricane Katrina, their response is the same. They're ready to completely, when the people are disoriented and confused and completely shocked, that's when they come in with their new program, which is basically to privatize everything and deregulate everything and let the corporations have everything. But
right.
They're using what they learned at MK Ultra.
I did not know that, but I'm not the least bit surprised by that. I've been researching this again and saw there are several organizations that are playing with this, like the Tavistock Institute of London, who does this stuff, and they call it sociatry, which is applying the psychiatry to society. And this is industrial psychiatry. This is the Ewan Kamring variety of psychiatry. You reminded me of George Soros, who does that, who's done that a couple of times. He George Soros bought the country of Georgia doing that.
Yeah, and so you could look at 9-1-1 as a good analogy, and a lot of us think it was an inside job, and therefore it was synthetic terrorism. It was planned, and the reason being it's trauma based mind control, where you're trying to do an entire society what, say, you and Cameron was able to do with a single person, and get people so disoriented that you can push through your economic programs. As of course Bush has,
right? Well, and not well. You know, it, one of the things that was clear to me was that 9/11 was another Reichstag fire. It's actually had an earlier beginning, which was the Oklahoma City bombing. The Patriot Act was written prior to the Oklahoma City bombing, and when OK bomb happened, they tried to push it through Congress, but the OK bomb wasn't quite shocking enough to disorient the nation enough to be able to allow them to push it through, so they had to come up with a second one. And the Patriot Act went through screamingly. I mean, it was passed, 5 days after the event.
Right, right.
Well, I really believe that was by design.
Oh, absolutely. Indeed, the Patriot Act has undergone several major revisions since it first appeared, and I believe it first appeared in Nazi Germany. When I am Newt Gingrich was a freshman congressman, he introduced what he called the Emergency Powers Act, I think that may have been the title. God, it has been so many decades since that now. And the thing that struck me when I read Newt Gingrich's plan to suspend the Constitution and give emergency powers to law enforcement so as to clean up the streets, it was virtually, there were big sections that were virtually word for word from the one that the Germans enacted after the Reichstag fire that put Adolf Hitler in control of the chancellery. I saw this. Newt Gingrich wanted to do the same damn thing. It didn't happen. But after a rewrite, it was floated after the OK bomb, and after a rewrite, it was passed after 9/11.
Yeah, perfect example. So dealing with mass trauma and mind control. Of course, that's not with HARP, but we know that the government wants to do that. That they have technologies to do that. That they have tried to keep secret. So I think what you're doing is very important. I mean, if there were to be orchestrated attempt on the part of the government to fake an alien invasion, the more of us that consider this as a possibility ahead of time, the better off we'll be able to respond.
Right, and you use the phrase the government, and I kind of blanch at that because it's too broad a stroke. It's not the government. It's a handful of people. It's a group, a conspiracy, quite literally a conspiracy. You look up the legal definition. The legal definition of conspiracy is two or more individuals who do not need to speak with or know each other, who are both who are all engaged in attempting to arrive at the same unlegal outcome, is the legal definition of conspiracy. And while the U.S. The media laughs at conspiracy and says it doesn't happen, you talk to any United States prosecutor, you talk to anybody who's in prison, 80 plus percent of the people who are in prison today, among the things they were convicted of was conspiracy too. Prosecutors love conspiracy because it doesn't require a great deal of proof in order to convince a jury or a judge that a conspiracy was engaged in.
Well, Jerry,
So this handful of people, would you care to elaborate?
In the HARP book, I speculate as to who might be behind HARP and this sort of thing and why. And in the HARP book, it was rather a shotgun blast. I listed everybody I could think of. More as the decade since has gone by, I've refined my thinking and refined my my research. And at this point, I see that there is an open conspiracy to create a global government. And this open conspiracy has been around for a couple of hundred years. I mean, it started with the ancient illuminated seers of Bavaria in 1776, and is today very well underway in the United Nations and the G8 and the Davos meetings and so forth. And what I see is there are two competing teams, each trying to put their version of a global government with police powers in position. And I call the two teams the banksters and the watermelons. The banksters are the ones that most people who are familiar with this subject know about, the international bankers, the multinational corporations, who are trying to create a from-the-top-down power structure that puts their individual businesses beyond the reach of individual sovereign nations, so that they control the means of wealth, they control the processes that runs the profits through their fingers and keeps them at the top of the heap. The other side are the watermelons, and these are the folks who are green on the outside and red on the inside. Communism is far from dead. There is collectivism is a major philosophy. You know, the Al Gores of the world want to save mankind by controlling mankind. They believe, in Nazi Germany it was the individual is nothing, the state is all. Today it is the individual is nothing, the race is all, the species is all. We're now trying to save the species rather than to save the master race. It's the same nonsense, but blown up to a bigger scale. And the watermelons, they don't want to control the profits, they want to destroy the profits. They believe that Western civilization is a bad idea, that our consumer-driven lifestyle is a crime against humanity. The mantra is North America produces 20% of the resources yet consumes 80% of the world's resources. This is seen as a crime against humanity, and if we can't police ourselves, well then somebody's going to have to do it for us. And they want to they are on record as saying that they want to turn the first world back to a pre-industrial revolution state. No more SUVs, we're going to go to work in ox carts. And this may be, I talk to a lot of liberals who go, yeah, that's right, yeah, absolutely, I'm in favor of that. I don't see them turning in their SUVs in great droves. They have a Prius.
Jerry, on that note, we need to say goodnight. And Dr. Carlstrom and Katie and I all appreciate you coming on our program and sharing with us all this information and work that you've done. And I want to. So, Katie and Eric, did you? We needed a. Are you there?
I am.
Well,
so
yeah,
I'm really wide awake
and I could keep going.
And I'd really like to thank you for your contribution, Jerry. And Eric, it was so good to co-host the show with you tonight.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Katie. And Jerry, thanks very much for your work. And it certainly was interesting. And I'd like to keep going, but I guess our time is up. The last couple of subjects have been extremely fascinating, especially, I feel like we certainly covered a lot of ground.
Well, okay.
All right. I do appreciate your having me on, and if I can put in a last pitch, I'd like all the listeners to go to my website, jerryesmith.com, JerryEsmith.com.
Well, and again, thank you guys very much.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Thank you. Good night.